Everybody loves the touchdown.
Scans the secondary, pulls it over the middle, leaping grab is made at the goal line. Is he in? Yes! It's a touchdown for Greg Jennings!
The grand slam.
Fly ball to center field. Ethier has done it again. It's a grand slam!
The buzzer beater.
Gets it to LeBron for three for the win. Yes!
But how do those players get to that moment? And who built the venue and signed the contracts? Each week, we dig into the business side of sports and give you the answers. This is Hour 3 of Sports Business Radio.
Come here, rude boy, boy, can you get it up?
Now, here's your host, Brian Berger, on 95.5 The Game.
Happy Sunday to you. Thanks for joining us to celebrate the seven-year anniversary of Sports Business Radio. 7 years ago this week, we launched on News Radio 750 AM KXL. 7 years later, we've had some terrific conversations on this show, and we're sharing with you a few of my favorite today. You've already heard from Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. You heard from NCAA President Mark Emmert last hour. And coming up in minutes at 11:15, Jack Nicklaus, like you've never heard him before. Insightful, candid. People ask me all the time, who would you rather interview, Jack Nicklaus or Tiger Woods? To me, it's not even close. Tiger Woods is scripted. It's corporate speak. He doesn't open up. He doesn't give you anything. Jack Nicklaus, as you're going to hear, it's like talking to the Yoda of golf. Is there anyone that's ever been more important to golf? First of all, I think Jack Nicklaus is the greatest player who ever played the game of golf. Statistically, majors-wise, that stands up right now, that argument. I don't care if Tiger does pass him or if anyone ever comes along and passes Jack. 18 majors, Bobby. 19 times in majors, he finished second. Let's say that he wins half of those. There's no conversation about anyone ever catching him for a major, at least probably not in my lifetime or your lifetime. Tiger Woods is at 14 right now. Many people doubt that he's going to get to 18 now. But if Jack was at 28, forget about it.
Oh, it'd be over.
19 times he finished second in majors. He won his last major 25 years ago this weekend. 1986, the Masters, 46 years old. His son carrying his bag as his caddy. He came into that tournament. His best finish to date was 39th place. There's a writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that wrote a story that week leading up to the Masters talking about how Jack was washed up. He shouldn't even be allowed to play at Augusta National. It was sad to see such a star fading late in his career. CBS carried the Masters, as they still continue to. And they didn't have all the cameras they had back then that they have today. And if you tuned into that last Sunday of the Masters, Jack wasn't even on the leaderboard. He teed off earlier because he wasn't in one of the final groups. He was an afterthought. 9 strokes behind entering the last round. As the day went on, and Jack started making his charge, the galleries started leaving Greg Norman, Seve Ballesteros, other guys that were leading the tournament, had no one following them. Greg Norman said there were about half a dozen people following him. He's in the leading group. Everyone migrated to Jack Nicklaus. They wanted to see history take place. They wanted to see, could this really be a storybook ending for a guy who's 46. Everyone said he was washed up. Hadn't won a major in, I think it was 6 years. And the charge he put on at age 46, 4 birdies and an eagle on the back nine. He shot a 30, Bobby. I usually shoot a 30 on the first 4 or 5 holes. And this is at Augusta National. A course that is tough to tame, but of course that Jack had won at 5 times previously. There's not a person alive that is old enough to remember that Masters that doesn't remember where they were watching that as Jack made that charge. And it was even more special because his son was carrying his bag. Terrific 30 for 30 documentary that just came out this week about Jack's charge at the Masters in 1986. And it's voiced by his son. And Tiger's in the documentary. Tiger talks about how he and his dad, Earl, he was 10 years old, sat around and watched Jack make this charge. Ernie Els was 16. He remembers watching Jack make the charge. It was historic. I mean, Tiger Woods is 35 years old, and some people are saying he may not win another major. Jack was 46 years old, and again, on the downside of his career. It was his last major. He won. It's one of the greatest sports accomplishments ever, I think. The other thing about Jack Nicklaus is post-career, he's had even more of an impact on golf than he did during his playing days. He's designing courses around the world. He's introducing the game of golf to people in countries like Russia and China and Poland. And I mean, it's amazing the impact he's leaving, because when he's dead and gone, these courses that he built and designed are going to stand for years to come. Not only here in the United States, but in countries around the world. He's one of the most, if not the most, sought after course designer in the world. He's got the Golden Bear brand attached to his name, which is golden. Here's a guy, and this is the thing I respect the most about Jack Nicklaus. And we talk about this during our conversation that's coming up here in minutes at 11:15. There's a lot of athletes that during their playing career, they disconnect from their family, whether they want to or not. They're on the road. They're caught up in their own world. They don't really have a great relationship with their spouse. They don't really know their kids. They certainly don't know their grandkids. And then when their playing days are done, it's like they've got to be reintroduced to their family. Jack Nicklaus is, he's John Wayne. He's a man's man. He's been married to the same woman forever. He's got a wonderful relationship with his sons to the point where they want to work with him in his businesses. He's got amazing grandkids that he supports. At the par three contest this week, his caddy for that was one of his grandsons, who's like a top player at Florida State. He's an amazing guy because he never forgot what was most important, and that was his family. Even the demands on his schedule today, he puts his family first. And to me, I respect that, because he could have easily said, I'm Jack Nicklaus. I'm running around the world. I'm doing this, that, or the other. Look, there's a lot of narcissists in sports. Me first. I. Jack Nicklaus played an individual sport and was mentally tough. Golf, you've got to be mentally tough. And Bobby, I look and see what he's meant to golf, but what he's done with his family. I can't think of any other athletes that resemble Jack Nicklaus. The only other guy that played a different sport, and he's also my other favorite athlete, and he's dead and gone now, unfortunately, is Walter Payton. Class act, did things in the community, promoted the game of football, was a great husband and a great father. And you don't find anyone who ever has anything bad to say about Walter Payton. It's the same thing with Jack Nicklaus. How do you not root for a guy like Jack Nicklaus?
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny, back in his day and age, he had to play golf to support his family.
Right.
And he had to do well to support his family. It's not like now where you can finish 30th in a tournament, still make, you know, $36,000,
right,
and be okay for the next couple weeks until you play again. This is a guy that's made more money outside of golf, post-career, designing courses than he has. Listen, if Jack Nicklaus played in this day and age and was as good as he was now, he would be a multi-billionaire just on winnings alone because of what he was able to accomplish.
Well, and think of all the endorsements he would have because his brand is authentic. As we learned last year, Tiger's brand was built on a house of cards. It was smoke and mirrors. It was not authentic. He was selling us family, and it was anything but. Jack Nicklaus has proven over decades what his brand is, and it's held up over the test of time. And we talk about, in this interview coming up in minutes, my interview with Jack Nicklaus, geez, do you ever feel like you played in the wrong era? And then he points out, well, how'd you like to be Ben Hogan or someone like that? Mm-hmm. And he knows Ben Hogan's career earnings because Tiger has dwarfed what Jack Nicklaus made in career earnings. Now, Jack Nicklaus is making a boatload of money off the Golden Bear brand, but he's also making a lot of money designing courses around the world and being a consultant and being a spokesperson for the Royal Bank of Scotland. I mean, if you're a company out there, can you have a more authentic, real, sparkling, clean reputation, someone with a high Q score than Jack Nicklaus? I mean, Jack Nicklaus is golf. Babe Ruth is baseball. There are just those guys out there that when you say their name, they're synonymous with excellence. That's Jack Nicklaus. And it was great to see him this week. You know, he, Arnold Palmer, Gary Player playing in the par three contest together. And you wonder how many of those do we have left of watching those three living legends playing together. And I hope we have many of them to come. But, you know, for me, I've had some amazing conversations on this show with high-profile people and not-so-high-profile people. Dick Hoyt, amazing father. Dick and Rick Hoyt, Google them. See what Dick Hoyt has done, the superhuman things he's done in marathons and Ironman competitions with his son. It's phenomenal. But for me, the most insightful, fun conversation, again, I felt like I was talking to the Yoda of golf, was with Jack Nicklaus in 2008. And we're going to look back on that conversation next. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
One-on-one with those making the big-time decisions that impact your sport. This is Sports Sense on Sports Business Radio. Sports Business Radio.
My guest is Jack Nicklaus. He's the winner of a record 18 major championships. He's the CEO of the Nicklaus Company and a goodwill ambassador for the game of golf. Mr. Nicklaus, it's an honor to have you on Sports Business Radio. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Brian.
So I got to tell you, in doing my research for this interview, I was struck by what an amazingly busy schedule you keep. You just finished hosting the Memorial. You're the head of the Nicklaus Companies. You travel to dozens of countries every year designing courses for Nicklaus Design. And you somehow find time to spend quality time with your wife, your children, your 21 grandchildren. You seem to be working more now than you were when you were playing regularly. Where do you get all this energy?
If I don't keep the energy up, you know, they put you away, or they farm you out or something, Brian. I don't know. I've always had energy. I've always been sort of one of those kids when I was growing up that I got up in the morning and I came in at night and my mom grabbed my ears, you know.
Right.
And but I've always had to be doing something. And people always say, well, gosh, you know, how do you do all this stuff? I said, well, you know, you got to remember, I was playing 25 weeks a year. I was traveling tournament golf and spending a week at a place. I don't do that anymore. I've got 25 free weeks now.
Right.
And so I'm going to fill them. I enjoyed filling them up and working and doing things. And it's, you know, most people work all their life to retire to play golf. I play golf all my life to retire to work.
Right.
And so I kind of enjoy that. And I've got the grandkids are growing up. My oldest just graduated from high school last week. And so I'm watching them in high school athletics, and I'll watch some of them with college and in the future. And so we're pretty active.
It's an exciting time for you, I'm sure. You're an incredible goodwill ambassador for the game of golf. You remain close to the United States Golf Association. As an endorsee of the Royal Bank of Scotland, you've entered into a deal that puts the USGA and the RBS together in a business relationship. The four-year agreement with the USGA features a number of components that will be integrated across all USGA championships, including the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open. So now RBS has ties to three of golf's four majors, is the official patron sponsor of the British Open Championship and the PGA Championship. Can you explain this new partnership between the RBS and the UGA and what your role is going to be going forward?
Well, you know, the RBS has been involved with the British Open for over 100 years.
Right.
And they part of what they've done, they've been a, you know, they were called, where they were, still are, the Royal Bank of Scotland. They felt like Royal Bank of Scotland was a little bit restrictive since they became the, I think the third largest bank in Europe. And now they're the fourth largest bank in the world, or the sixth largest bank in the United States. And my role was to help them transition from the World Bank of Scotland to RBS. And they used me as that vehicle. And so through the advertising and promotion of my involvement with them, I think a lot of people realize that RBS is a pretty significant player in the United States today.
Absolutely.
And part of that has been all through the game of golf. So the natural relationship of being involved with the British Open, they wanted to expand that to be involved with golf's best. So they want to be involved with the USGA and the PGA and their championships also. And they are. And, you know, I'm sort of that vehicle to bring them together from the game of golf. And it's been a very nice relationship. It's been great for me, and I'm sure it's been great for RBS, or they wouldn't continue to have me.
Yeah, I'm sure. I love the commercials that they've done with you, too. I think those are great. You know, I look at what you've done and just what you've meant to the game of golf, not only when you played, but now you have Nicholas Design. It's an incredibly successful golf course design company. You've designed courses in 45 countries around the world. There's 300 Nicholas courses. You're designing 100 more. And between what you're doing with the USGA to promote the game of golf and these courses you're designing, what a legacy you're leaving for future golfers.
Well, you know, it's a game that gave me so much, and it's a game that I want to continue to be part of and continue to grow with it. One of the neat things about the things I'm doing is that we're actually working in 29 new countries now, as well as all the other countries we've been working in.
Wow.
And, you know, we go into these countries, and a lot of them, we're the first golf course in that country.
That's got to be fun.
And to have the opportunity to form the shape of what that game is going to be in that country and its future is kind of fun to go into mostly the Eastern Bloc now with this country, going into Russia, Poland, you know, Bulgaria, Ukraine, all the way down through Romania and Czech Republic, so forth and so on. All those are all new places. And, you know, they all will grow up now on a pretty decent golf course, and the young people that come from there will be able to compete around the world and make the game more of a global game, continue to grow it. And that's kind of fun to be part of that.
I've got to ask you a question as a designer. You're the greatest golfer who ever lived. So when you're designing a course, how do you put yourself in someone like my shoes? I'm a duffer. And when you're designing these holes, how do you think in terms of someone like me instead of Jack Nicklaus, greatest golfer who ever played?
Well, I think that we've done over 300 golf courses, so I think when you start to look at it, you pretty well figure out that who's going to play it, and you know only 1.8% of your play is played from the back tees. So you're really designing the golf course for 98.2% of the people, and so you really better be designing from the members tees because that's where your bread and butter comes from. And so you've got to figure out how does the average golfer hit it? How do the women hit it? How do juniors? How do beginners? You got to try to figure out how that's going to work, and you just keep working with it and try to play them around. I mean, some of the first golf courses I did were very difficult golf courses because they were done for tournament golf.
Right.
And like Muirfield is a difficult golf course. Shoal Creek, Castle Pines, they were all done for tournament golf. Well, then all of a sudden I figured out. I said, you know, I'm really not designing this golf course for 1 week a year. I should be designing this golf course for 51 weeks a year.
Right.
And adapting it to a tournament. I think if I look back at Augusta, I think Augusta was that. Augusta is a wonderful golf course. It's a wonderful members golf course. All they did was move the tees back and hide the pins, and they played the Masters. So that philosophy I've always thought has been pretty darn good. And, you know, it worked for the Masters and it's been successful. Why not try to take it forward? So I try to look at that kind of a thing and when I'm designing. And I think it's... I think it's been successful. We sometimes don't get it right every time, but a lot of times we do. And I think we've got a lot of people that have enjoyed our golf courses and enjoy playing them and living there. So it's and it's been fun to be able to be part of it.
I would imagine that people find you. If someone wants to hire Jack Nicklaus to design their course, how does that process take place? I mean, I see your website, and obviously you've got a pristine reputation, but, you know, these people in third bloc countries, Eastern bloc countries, how do they find you and bring you in to design their courses?
Well, they figure it out somehow, because they get to us. And, you know, most of the stuff comes into the office, although we do have... I have an office in Moscow, and I got an office in Brussels. I got an office in Seoul, an office in Hong Kong, Beijing, South Africa, representatives in Argentina. And I've got people in all parts of the world. And so, you know, we're doing golf courses in all parts of the world. So people generally figure out that, hey, Jack's doing a golf course in China, we ought to be able to figure out where is he doing China. We talk to those people. We're going to a golf course in Russia. How do we talk to those people over there if we want one in Bulgaria? You know, I mean, they figure out how to get to us. Otherwise, and our people are always prospecting. And frankly, you know, the internet's been a great source of our business. I would say that 10 years ago we got maybe 5% of our leads off of the internet, and I'd say today we probably get 60-70% of our leads off the internet.
Wow, that's amazing. I would have never guessed that.
I wouldn't have either, but it actually is a fact.
More of my conversation with Jack Nicklaus coming up next. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Confused about the business side of sports? We'll fill you in. This is SBR on Sports Radio 95.5, The Game.
Now back to my conversation with Jack Nicklaus. Mr. Nicklaus, there's lots of talk, obviously, about Tiger Woods eventually breaking your record of 18 major championships. Tiger sits at 13 right now as we speak. A remarkable stat that very few people realize is that you finished second 19 times out of the 162 majors you played in. So if you won half of those, you'd have 28 major championships. I think what Tiger's doing is incredible, but, I mean, let's be realistic here. If you had 28 majors, we wouldn't talk about Tiger breaking your record at all. Who faced the stiffer competition, you or Tiger? For my vote, you did.
Well, thank you. But first of all, I failed 19 times then. That's sort of the way I look at it, Brian. I mean, I got beater. I failed 19 times where I came close, and I won 18 times. So. But you know, you're going to lose sometimes when you're in contention, and I think that the competition that I had, I think there it was very difficult. I mean, and the reason I think it was difficult is because we had fewer really good players, but the good players we had all learned how to win, and they'd all won 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 majors. You know, Arnold and Gary and Trevino and Watson. Those guys all knew how to win. And if I slipped up, they were ready to play. The problem today is that we have Tiger, and then we have so many other really, really good players, but there's just not enough, they don't get enough exposure of winning to really feel confident coming down the stretch that they're going to make it happen. So I don't know really how to answer the question properly. There are probably more good players today, but yet ours had the experience to learn how to win. So you don't know really what is right.
We hear the story about a young Tiger taping a sheet with your stats on his bedroom wall and kind of being fixated on catching you someday. Who was the guy that you were maybe fixated on? Was it Arnold Palmer as you were growing up and you said, that's who I want to be, or that's who I want to break all of his records?
Well, Bobby Jones, actually. Bobby Jones won the U.S. Open at Scioto in 1926, and I grew up at Scioto. I started playing golf course in 1950, and there were many golfers that are members of that club that were there when Jones won, including my father. And so I never heard anything other but Jones, 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 and I never really thought anything about breaking any records. We didn't have that kind of pressure. Tigers had it on from day one. But, I mean, it wasn't until 1970 that I won my 10th major. And I walked in the press room, and Bob Green of the AP said, Jack, that's 10 majors you won now. Congratulations. You only got 3 more to tie Bobby Jones. I said, what? I mean, I'll be very honest with you, I had never counted them. I never even dreamed of it, never even entered my mind. And I never thought Bobby Jones' 13 majors was approachable. And then all of a sudden, I was three away from it. Then I actually focused on it. And then when I focused on it, I got past it. And, I just played, tried to win what I could after that. And but you pretty much, once you pass something, you lose your drive to go on. I wanted to play golf, I just didn't I didn't drive as hard as I did when I was younger. But my record is what it is. I certainly wish, I'm quite happy with what it is. Do I wish it was more? Sure. Now I do.
Sure.
But how did I know Tiger Woods was going to come along? Or how did Bobby Jones know Jack Nicklaus was going to come along? You know, it really isn't important. Tiger is a great player. He's doing and dominating the game today. He's a nice young man. He's handles himself well. The game's in good hands. So if he breaks my record, more power to him. I just want to be the first one to shake his hand. And obviously nobody wants their records to be broken, but I think it brings more excitement into the game to have Tiger chasing my record. Obviously, it puts my name in the newspaper every day right beside his. So,
sure.
It's not all that bad for me either. So, but it's kind of exciting. It's kind of fun to watch him play. He's a very, very talented young man and fun to watch.
One of the things that's so different, obviously, today is compared to when you played, the prize money. I mean, Tiger's made $93 million on the tour. You won 113 tournaments and you earned a little bit less than $6 million in your entire career on the tour. Obviously, I would guess you're earning a lot more than that with Nicklaus Design and your other endeavors now, but do you ever look back and just go, gosh, I played in the wrong era. I could be making a lot more money now with 113 victories.
Well, I think Ben Hogan actually looked like he thought maybe he played in the wrong era.
Yeah, no kidding.
His total lifetime earnings were like $241,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you really look at that, I mean, it's just times change. And, what I look at is I think that the kids today are really blessed. They have the opportunity to play golf for a living. And we played golf and had to be successful so we could go make a living. With outside things, you never made a living on a golf course when we played.
Right.
And today the kids can actually play golf and don't have to do anything else. They can play golf and make a living. And I think that's neat. And we were the forerunners of that. We, the group in front of us, the Hogans and the Nelsons and the Sneeds were the forerunners of that. And then we came in and then we were the ones that started to get it to the next level. And then Tiger and his group were taking it to the next level. And I think it's great for the game.
Jack, Father's Day is next weekend. All four of your sons work for you, and you won your last major in 1986, the Masters, with your son Jack carrying your bag for you. That had to have been a wonderful thrill. Talk about the wonderful bond that you've built with your sons. Honestly, I see a lot of athletes who play, and they're so involved in their athletic endeavors that their relationship with their family suffers, and I've got to tip my hat to you because you seem like you're so close with your family, and I think that's just so admirable.
Well, that's always been the most important thing in my life, Brian. I mean, my wife and I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio. We both have same values. We both felt like we both came from close families, and we both felt like family was the most important thing. And I probably could have won a lot more tournaments if I would have sort of been selfish enough to leave my family. But I just didn't want to do that. My family is what I wanted to be part of, and my kids are all working with me. They're all doing things that are similar to what I do. They're all trying to handle their kids the way I handle them, which makes me proud. I've got a good group of kids, and they're good citizens, and they do well. And I think that's what my wife and I are most proud of.
Right. I mean, it's such a wonderful trait and quality that you have, and think of all the generations that you've affected. Last question for you. Obviously, you've played the game of golf all your life. You've been there with golf during some incredibly joyous moments like we discussed with the 1986 Masters, but golf has been an outlet for you for some incredibly somber moments as well. What are the main lessons the game of golf can teach us if we pay close enough attention?
Well, I think the game is a game that you get out of it what you put into it. And you get you develop relationships with people. I think you play 18 holes of golf with somebody, you get to know them pretty well.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, you know what kind of a sport they are. You know what kind of a personality they got. You know whether they're a hothead or whether they'll enjoy the game for the game or they're driven by total competition or they're driven for greed or whatever they're driven by, and you find that out pretty quickly on the golf course. So it's a great game for that. It's a great game for people. It's a great game for a father to play with a son. It's a great game for a grandfather to play with his grandson or granddaughter. And you know, it can be played by all walks of life and people of all handicaps and all abilities. It's just a marvelous game, and there's not many games like that. So to be fortunate enough to be involved in that game all my life has been a very, very special thing for me. And it's you meet the same people on the way down that you meet on the way up, Brian. You know that, and so you better watch your P's and Q's on the way up, because you're going to have to either you're going to have to eat them on the way down if you haven't handled it right.
Well, it's great, great advice, and it's such an honor to speak with you. You've always conducted yourself in such a wonderful manner on and off the course, and I really wish you the best in all of your endeavors moving forward.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, too. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
I want to remind you this hour of Sports Business Radio is presented by Berg Car Company. Visit them at 10680 Southwest Canyon Road in Beaverton, or go online to bergcarworld.com. Go see my friend Neil Berg. Tell him Brian Berger from Sports Business Radio sent you, and he'll take very good care of you. All right, it's time for our headlines of the week, and let's start with the NCAA basketball championship. Bobby, as I said on Twitter on Monday night, I haven't seen shooting this bad since Dick Cheney's last hunting trip. It was abysmal shooting. 18% for Butler. Ratings down 18% from last year's Butler-Duke finals to this year's UConn-Butler finals. But the good news is, overall for the tournament, the best ratings, the most viewers since 2005. So CBS, TBS, TNT, True TV, going across four networks, being able to watch the games live was great. It was a recipe that worked. The other thing we wondered about before the tournament, March Madness on demand, online, people watch online. Are less people going to watch online because more people can watch on TV now and you can watch every game live? That didn't happen. 13.7 million hours of stream video. That's up 17% from 2010. So more people, 17% more, tuned in to watch online as well, which is good for their sponsors, because you have sponsors who say, you know what, I don't want to be on TV, I just want to be online. I want to be where people can click through to my website and, you know, I can do some other fun things via the website, and their numbers online continue to be strong. And really, I can't think of another entity where more people watch online. If you're at work, you want to watch March Madness, you're not around a TV, you're clicking on your computer to watch. So all in all, besides a stinker of a final, it was pretty good for CBS and for the NCAA, and obviously for Turner as well. We had our Sports Business Radio March Madness Bracket Challenge, and we want to congratulate Linda Dowden, who correctly picked UConn. She's the only person in our pool that did pick UConn, and she's the winner of our Bracket Challenge. And the good news for me is that I didn't finish last amongst all of our listeners, and I also finished second amongst our Sports Business Radio team. Brian Griggs, our national show producer, finished first. I was second. Usually I'm in the bottom of the standing, so at least I can show my face, Bobby, this year and not be completely embarrassed about my selections in the March Madness bracket.
Hey, at least you were there toward the end, and that's all that matters. You know, I didn't have my Michigan State boys to rely on and make another great run, so I won that last year. But you know what? Hey, listen, we all have our off years, and I'll be back next year.
Our next headline, the Masters. A lot of business around the Masters. And the Masters, Augusta National, has always been known as this stuffy, elitist organization. They don't think outside the box. They're stuck in the 1960s. Well, guess what? This year, it's like a whole new world. First of all, we learn that starting in 2012, those badges that were passed down from generation to generation that you couldn't get your hands on, you're going to be able to buy online. So the public is going to be able to go to the Masters more so starting next year than they ever have before. If you go to masters.com, you're going to be able to buy tickets online. They're going to do all their ticketing online instead of like in the olden days where they hand out little printed tickets and badges. So it's a whole new ticketing system, and a lot more people are going to be able to go to the Masters starting in 2012. That's one progressive thing for Augusta National. The other thing is, if you're a video game player, I'm not, but if you are, you were never able in any game to play Augusta National. Well, what's one of the first courses that people want to play in a video game or Augusta. Online? It's Augusta National. Well, Augusta National would never release the rights so you could play on their course. That changed this year, too. EA Sports, Tiger Woods, PGA Tour 12, the Masters. The Masters says they're trying to attract more youth to golf. Even Augusta National Chair Billy Payne, his press conference this week, he said he played the game with his 12-year-old grandson. This is Billy Payne. I didn't even know he knew what a video game was. He's sitting at his press conference talking about video games and apps for your iPhone and your Droid. It's like, wait a minute. Who inhabited Billy Payne's body and like made him this progressive guy? I wonder how much media training he needed and how much people needed to explain to him about video games and apps and things like that. But the good news for the consumer, the Masters and Augusta National, they're loosening the tie. Yep. They're unbuttoning the top button from the collar a little bit, and they're saying, we're not as stuffy and elitist, and we understand that for the long-term longevity of our brand, we need to be a little bit more open to embracing technology and letting in some of the riffraff, maybe. Now, the pimento cheese sandwiches, I guess they had some problems with those this weekend. And those are like one of the favorites of people who are coming to the Masters. I haven't been. I'm really hoping to go. It's on my bucket list of things to do. I want to go with my dad. But, you know, hey, look, I tip my hat to Augusta National and to Chair Billy Payne for finally embracing technology and for being a little bit more open to dealing with just the elite people. Our last headline of the week. This is not good news if you're an NFL fan. The federal judge overseeing the NFL players' request to lift a lockout by the owners said it's going to take her a couple of weeks to rule. Have you ever been involved in the legal system? Things do not move fast. Lawyers go back and forth. Court dates get reset. People need time to do discovery. Things don't happen quickly. And now you've got the judge saying, you know what? I did my homework, but I'm calling a timeout. I need a few more weeks to study. You know what this is really about, Bobby? U.S. District Court Judge Susan Richard Nelson is urging both sides to get back to the bargaining table. She has said to them, like most judges say, if you ever find yourself in court, don't make me be the one who decides your fate. You two sides get together and work it out. The problem with that, Bobby, is that most people wouldn't be standing in front of a judge in the first place if they could work it out on their own. And in the case of the NFL, they're now a federal trade association. They are no longer a union. So a union can't go to the bargaining table and make a deal with the owners. You got to put Humpty Dumpty back together again and form the union again. The players aren't going to do that because then this gets thrown out of the courts. And the antitrust laws come into effect. So it's a mess. I didn't think there was going to be a work stoppage before as far as missing some games this season. I think there's going to be now. All right, a lot of thank yous on our show today. Our show staff, Bobby Courser, Brian Griggs, Josh Blank, Jared Melzer, Patrick O'Neill, Brian Jennings, Bill Ashington, and intern Mitch. A podcast reminder, you can catch our show on demand via podcast every week. Just go to our website, sportsbusinessradio.com. You can find us on iTunes. I'm on Twitter, at SB Radio. It's been a great 7 years. We're with you every Sunday, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on 95.5 The Game. For Bobby Courser, I'm Brian Berger. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next Sunday right here on Sports Business
Radio.